story. I know that I am excited and we'll be in the story series probably about through Thanksgiving, thereabouts. So I don't know if you've ever had one of those kinds of projects where maybe you just get so frustrated, or maybe it's not a project, maybe it's just something in life, where you get so frustrated that you just give up on it. I mean, maybe, for example, somebody gives you a recipe, and you cook it, and you've tried that recipe over and over and over, and it never comes out like the person that gave it to you. And finally, you're just like, forget it, I'll just wait till they give me some. Or maybe it's a lawnmower, and it just won't run right, and you tinker with it, and you tinker with it, and finally, out of frustration, you just say, forget it, I'm just going to go buy me a new lawnmower. Or maybe some of you, maybe it's your golf swing. And like, you cannot seem to master the driver. And finally, you're like, I'm just leaving the drivers in the bag. And I'm just going to, even on a 500-yard hole, I'm just going to tee off with my one iron because I just give up on it. Or maybe it's a subject in school. And you work on it, and you study, and you've got a mentor, and you've gone online and tried to get all kinds of help online, and you just can't get it. And you're just like, you know, if I have to change my major, I'll change my major. I am just done with it. I had such a frustrating project a few years ago. I had this little sports car, right? Here's a picture of my sports car. So a few years ago, the heater core on that car, the heater quit working. Because, well, let's just say I'm not going to talk about my wife's driving skills this morning. But anyway, Jim Queen, a mechanic in our church sitting back here, helped, and some other men in the church kind of got it roadworthy after its mishap. But he told me, he said, the heater got shoved over in this little mishap that happened. And it's not going to work. And you'd have to take out the entire dash to fix that. And we're, nah, that's all right. I'll live without a heater, right? Well, eventually, you get into the wintertime, and you're kind of like, it'd be nice to have a heater, right? Especially when you have a convertible. And so I went online, and it turned out there were some ways that you could fix the heater without taking the whole dash out. And so I decided one afternoon that I was going to attempt such a project. And so I'm not a real big person, obviously, and that's a pretty small car, though. So to get to this heater core, basically you have to fold yourself up like a pretzel and cram yourself down in there, and there's about literally a quarter of an inch that you can slide this heater core out, and the steering column's in your way. So I'm cramming myself and then twisting myself up like a pretzel, and my feet are up in the air over the seats. And of course, every time I try to move, you know, the seats are trying to pull my pants down, and so I'm all smushed up in there, and, you know, you can't really see, so you got to get a flashlight. You can't get the flashlight to stay where it's supposed to, and it keeps falling. Then I put the flashlight like this, and I'm trying to hold it between my ear and my shoulder, and that's not working. So then I put it in my mouth, and I hold the flashlight, and got the screwdriver like right here because you can't see anything, and I'm trying to turn the thing, and you get like a 16th of an inch at a time, and try to keep my pants on. And I wish you could see a picture of this. Actually, thankfully, there are no pictures. But anyway, so I'm going to try to get this thing out, twisted and crammed and smushed up in there. You know, you turn it like a 16th of an inch at a time. You guys that have done this kind of stuff know what I'm talking about. And, you know, it's just kind of miserable. And, you know, just kind of barely working it. And finally, I get it out, fix it, put it all back together. And of course, you know what happens when you're crammed in those little spaces. And again, you people have done this kind of stuff know what I mean. You get cramps in your hands, and you have to stop and pull yourself out, and then you have to reposition yourself back all in there, and then your neck gets cramps, and it's just kind of just miserable. But I finally get it. Put it all back together. It's been about 2 hours. And start the car. Works good. No leaks. 5 minutes goes by. Rev it up a little bit. Then I start smelling antifreeze. Tad burn. So here we go again. Crawl, smush, flashlights, all that stuff again. Get the leak taken care of. Rev it back up. Get it all back together. Rev it up. This time there are no leaks. All right. We're good to go. Driving for about 4 or 5 days, and I smell antifreeze. So the next weekend, here we go again. This goes on for about a month. I'll fix it. It seems to be okay for 3 or 4 days a week, and then it messes up again. Take it apart, fix it, 2-hour ordeal, then it happens again. So finally, after about a month or 6 weeks of this, I'm driving one day, I thought I had it fixed again, and I feel hot water spraying on my pants leg. I mean, just shh. And by the time I get home, I get out of the car, and there's like this much antifreeze in the floorboard of my car, like 1.5, 2 inches of antifreeze. And I look down at all that antifreeze there that I'm going to have to clean up, and I'm just like, who needs a stinking heater, right? And I bypass that thing, and I haven't touched it since. I mean, I could live without a heater, right? Well, I think that's kind of an image that God gives us in the Old Testament. Sometimes we just lose hope and we give up. I think everybody in the room can kind of identify with that, because we know what it's like to work and work at something and then just kind of give up hope. Maybe you're sitting here this morning and you look at our country and you feel like I did when you looked at that puddle of antifreeze in the floorboard. It just seems like the leak got bigger and bigger, and the hole gets bigger and bigger, and the radiator's running dry. And you're kind of in a panic mode because you just don't see how our country is going to fix itself. Or maybe it's your marriage. And you're in love, and it was happily ever after, and everything was going to be great, but then it just seems like you've had to work on it and repair it and work on it, and you've done that over and over, and the water level continues to drop. You don't have a lot of hope left. I mean, that's how you feel about your children. Yeah, you weren't perfect. And maybe there's some do-overs that you'd really like to have, but you look at some of their decisions that they're making today, and you're just like, what happened? Or maybe it's your finances. Maybe you went on vacation this summer and there were some unexpected expenses and you didn't get to go. Or maybe you're watching your retirement and it just seems like it's just leaking out. And this thing comes up and that thing comes up, and the hole's just getting bigger and bigger. And you've tried to stop the leaks and it just keeps on going. That's an image of idolatry in the Old Testament. And that's what Jeremiah is going to talk to us today about in Jeremiah chapter 2. Putting your hope in the wrong things. Because when you put your hope in something other than God, eventually it's going to spring a leak, it's going to drain out, and what you put your hope in is going to dry up. So what I want to do, it's been last May since we were last in this series, I want to kind of recap things just a little bit. I'm not going to spend a lot of time recapping, but I want to go back to last May when we kind of ended the story, and we were kind of talking about, we were in that section where the kings were being warned by the prophets. And that's kind of our first point this morning in the recap, is the prophets were coming along and they were warning the nation of Israel. That had happened over a 200-year period. What were the prophets warning the nation about? Do you remember? Well, over and over, Israel would move away from God. And they would worship idols and they would worship other things. And these prophets would come along and they would call the people back. They said, look, you need to change. You need to do things differently. And if you don't, there are going to be consequences. So this happens for over a 200-year period, like 208 years. God warns the people. Periodically, they turn, but then they go back to what they were doing before, which wasn't godly. And God just sends these warnings over and over, and finally it's like, God's like, I've had enough. And the last Sunday that we were in the story, it was May 20th, We were talking about the two kingdoms, and you may remember a little bit, there were two kingdoms. There was the northern kingdom, which was Israel, and then there was the lower kingdom, which was Judah, because the nation of Israel had split. So you had two kingdoms made up of the Israelite people. And the Boam boys we talked about were the kings, Jeroboam and Rehoboam. And so you had those two. And in that last sermon, we talked about how the Assyrian army, 185,000 strong, came in and knocked out the nation of Israel, the northern kingdom. And as you can tell from that map up there, the southern kingdom's next. They've seen what happened to their neighbors to the north. But there's an X factor. Remember him? His name was King Hezekiah. And he was a godly man, and he sought God's face, and he turned the country back the way they were supposed to be. But then he passes away. His son Manasseh takes over. Manasseh is not a godly man. And God says, enough. And so this time, Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonian army come in. They take over the country of Judah. And basically, all that's left is Jerusalem. They don't really, they occupy Jerusalem per se, but they still allow the kings to follow the succession and all those kind of things. And so King Zedekiah, he becomes the king. And so there's only a remnant left, so to speak, in Jerusalem out of all Israel and Judah. And so God continues. There's just this little remnant left in the city of Jerusalem there, but God continues to warn them. And we see a second warning from Ezekiel. I want you to listen, and it'll be up on the screen there. Notice the strong verbs here. Just listen to this. God talking to the nation. I am about to bring a sword against you, and I will destroy your high places. Your altars will be demolished. Your incense altars will be smashed. And I will slay your people in front of your idols. I will lay the dead bodies of the Israelites in front of their idols. I will scatter your bones around your altars. And you will know that I am the Lord. Wouldn't you say that's a pretty strong message? I mean, the verbs. Smash, destroy, demolish. But you know that message wasn't heeded. Have you ever kind of given a threat to your children like, if you don't do this, this is what's going to happen? You ever do that? So you tell them, if you don't stop, this is what's going to happen. And so they do it. And you're like, if you do that again, this is what's going to happen. And they do it again. And then you're like, I'm telling you, if you do that again, and maybe you're doing the timeout thing, one, two and a quarter, two and a half. Your children just laughing at you. But why is it we don't want to punish them? Because deep down, most parents don't want to punish their kids. In fact, I don't think anyone wants to punish their kids. You don't want to see them cry. From the time they were a baby, you wanted the best for them. You hoped they'll thrive and enjoy life and reach their full potential. I think that's how God looked at the nation of Israel. I think that's how he looks at us. He wants us to enjoy life with him. So despite all of the warnings, he gives the nation, what's left of it, another chance. Most of the nation is in exile, but he gives them another chance. And he sends this prophet, Jeremiah, which is our third point this morning. He's known as the weeping prophet. He sends Jeremiah to warn what's left of the nation one more time. If you'll change, if you'll do what you're supposed to. Now, Jeremiah, for his part, you know, this isn't exactly, you know, like one of the Bible's plum assignments. I mean, to have to go and warn the people and all the things that have happened. And Jeremiah's like, chapter 1 of Jeremiah, Jeremiah's like, I'm not really a good speaker. And God's like, that's okay, I'll tell you what to say. And Jeremiah's like, I'm too young. God says, That's all right. I'll be with you. And he tells Jeremiah. And some of this sounds like Genesis stuff, doesn't it? You know, and Moses didn't want to go. And then in Genesis, when Abraham and Lot, God tells Jeremiah, if you can find one decent citizen, I'll hold back my judgment. Sums it up this way. But they mocked God's messengers, talking about the prophets, despised his words, and scoffed at his prophets until the wrath of the Lord was aroused against his people, and there was no remedy. Do you know when the God of the universe says there's no remedy? It's over. I mean, it is over. King Zedekiah was the king at this point, and he begs Jeremiah. Jeremiah says to him, no, it's too late. God has already handed you over to Nebuchadnezzar, and Nebuchadnezzar's not going to show you any mercy. He's not going to show you any pity. He's not going to show you any compassion. And in 586 B.C., it ends. Nebuchadnezzar comes in with his army. It wasn't pretty. They take King Zedekiah and they make him watch as they kill all of his sons in front of him. They gouge his eyes out and send him off to Babylon. They set the city ablaze. They destroy the temple and they destroy the city of Jerusalem. And when it's all over, the temple's gone, the city's gone, and the nation of Israel ceases to exist. So we know how it ends. Here's what I want to do this morning. I want us to kind of backtrack. Go back to Jeremiah chapter 2, and this would be before Nebuchadnezzar comes in and destroys Jerusalem. And I want to look very specifically at the warning that God gives Jeremiah to tell the people of Israel. Because I think there are some things in there that are very good for us to hear and think about in our own lives. Now I want you to understand this about Jeremiah. Jeremiah is not preaching hellfire and brimstone. He's not yelling at the people. He is called the weeping prophet because he is pleading with the people and he is crying. And he's going, please, please, change. But the people don't listen to him. So I want to start in chapter 2 with verses 9 through 13 as we look at this warning that he is giving the people. It begins, therefore, I bring these charges against you again. What does that word again mean? It means we've been here before. This has happened. These warnings have come over and over. And then God goes on to say, I will bring these charges against your children's children. Cross over to the coast of Cyprus and look. Send to Kedar and observe closely. See if there has ever been anything like this. Has a nation ever changed its gods, yet they are not even gods at all? So here's what he's saying. In other words, other nations don't change their gods. And their gods aren't even real. They don't even have the true living God, and they don't change their God. But you who have the real living God, you are changing your gods. It doesn't make sense. And he goes on, but my people have exchanged their God, their glory for worthless idols. Be appalled at this, O heavens, and shudder with great horror, declares the Lord. My people have committed two sins. He gives the first one. They have forsaken me, the spring of living water. And then the second one. And have dug their own cisterns, broken cisterns that cannot hold water. So here's what God's doing through Jeremiah through these words. He encapsulates all of their sin kind of under one umbrella. You know what that one umbrella is and what that one sin is that he's encapsulating it all under? Idolatry. He's putting all these sins that they have under one umbrella of idolatry. He said, here's the problem with you. You have these worthless idols. And then he compares the idols to cisterns. You have forsaken me, and you have dug your own cisterns or your own idols, and these cisterns don't even hold water. These gods that you have made are like a cistern that doesn't hold water. They don't work. A cistern doesn't work if it doesn't hold water. These gods certainly don't work. And so Jeremiah is trying to help us and them understand that idolatry is not just kind of a sin, but it is a sin that many other sins fall under. Does that kind of make sense? Let me give you some examples. Some of you are sitting here this morning. You know, idolatry has been a recurring theme in this series. Oh, I don't have any little statues in my house that we worship. You know, we don't do that kind of thing. That's not a struggle for me. But yeah, I do have a hard time with materialism and contentment, and I kind of want what other people have, and jealousy. Where does that come from? Well, it comes from putting stuff and things and money at the throne of your heart. And it's what you live for. And it's what you want more than anything else. And it surfaces as the sins of materialism, jealousy, discontentment. But what is it really? It's idolatry. It's putting that stuff in front of God. I don't have a problem with idolatry. You say, I'm just anxious. I just worry a lot. Okay. Where does that come from? Well, maybe you've made comfort and security your God. And because you're so concerned about being comfortable and secure in the future, it translates into fear, anxiety, worry. And it's really an idol. I don't struggle with idolatry, you say. I struggle with lust. Well, what is lust? It's worshiping sexual pleasure. And so you're choosing to worship sexual pleasure instead of worshiping God. That's an idol. So Jeremiah uses this metaphor of the cistern to help people understand what he's talking about. So what is a cistern? And that's pretty relevant to what we're talking about this morning. Well, a cistern is something that holds water. And when I lived up in North Carolina, we had a cistern for a while that fed the camp that I was working at there. And ours was tapped into an underground spring higher up, and we ran a black water pipe out of it, and then it went into this kind of good. Yeah, there's a picture. That's not the one we have, but you get the general idea. And ours had a lot better top on it than that. But the problem with cisterns is they took a lot of maintenance. You know, it was always getting sticks and twigs and that kind of thing and blocking up. And sediment was a real issue because the sediment would wash out and go downstream, so to speak, and get into all the faucets and the commodes and that kind of thing. And you constantly had to open those up and clean up all the valves and spigots and those kind of things because of the sediment. So it was just this maintenance hassle. Well, cisterns in ancient times were problematic too, but they were a necessity because a lot of these arid areas, they wouldn't get rain for 6 months a year. So they would build these cisterns, and that's actually one located over in the ancient Near East. But they were always having trouble with them. They would leak. As you can imagine, one like that, maybe a rat would fall in it and then drown, and you can imagine what that water might taste like when something like that happened. And so, you know, they were just very problematic for those people and just kind of a huge pain for them. But archaeologists have discovered all kinds of cisterns in that area. And they were just always having to dig them and repair them because, you know, they're just kind of stone stacked back in that day and clay and that kind of stuff, whatever they could to kind of hold the water in. And there were always problems with them. But they found all of these cisterns. And God is saying it's like you keep digging your cisterns, but it's kind of ridiculous because I am the living water, I'm right there. And basically what he's saying, it's almost like a rhetorical question. Why are you digging cisterns when the true living God is the spring right next to the cistern? In other words, why do you need a cistern if you have a stream right there? He says, why do you want these idols when you have me, the true living God? It's like a rhetorical question. Well, of course you wouldn't. But that's idolatry. God has provided himself, he said to the Israelites, and you have rejected him. And you have replaced me with something that doesn't give life. We still do that today. What a crazy example in our culture. A few years ago, a hotel in England, the Damson Demi Hotel, they took all the Bibles out of the hotel rooms and replaced them with another book. Do you know what book it was? 50 Shades of Grey. So they took God's word, God's truth, they took it out and exchanged it with basically this dark, lust-filled, soft pornographic novel, whatever you want to call it. They're taking God's truth, they're removing it, and they're putting a different source in its place. That's what idolatry looks like in 2018. We don't call it that, but we still struggle with idolatry. We're still digging our own cisterns. We're still looking to God. Maybe instead of looking to God for comfort, you look to food and entertainment. Or maybe instead of looking to God for significance, you look to your career or your accomplishments. Instead of looking to God for security, you look at your portfolio. Instead of looking to God for joy, you're looking at your children and your marriage. Instead of looking to God for hope, you look at the political process. Maybe instead of looking to God for truth, you're looking at academia. Maybe instead of looking to God for help, you go into the self-help books. None of those things are bad or wrong until we start replacing God with them. And we begin to look to them for hope. That's when it becomes idolatry, and it doesn't work. Those are the charges that God brings against these people. A couple things, and we'll be done this morning. I want us to kind of think about. When we're drinking from a cistern instead of God's living water, I think oftentimes we are literally worn out from digging all the cisterns. And God makes that point about these people. He says, they have dug their own cisterns. I don't know when the last time you dug a hole in hard ground, but it's hard work. It can be exhausting. I grew up in West Texas, and my grandfather had a ranch, and average 13, 15 inches of rainfall a year. And the ground would be so hard, but you still got to put in fences and stuff like that. And you could put those little like post-hole attachments on the back of a tractor that are supposed to dig a hole. And the ground would just laugh at those things. I mean, they'd just spin, maybe an hour and go like that. It's like it was polishing the dirt instead of actually digging in. So you just had to dig them by hand with postal diggers and one of those big, heavy kind of bars that you'd get in there. I mean, it was hard, exhausting work. Digging is difficult. And that's what those people were doing back then. They're digging these cisterns, and it's exhausting work. But you know, when you're trying to substitute all kinds of other stuff for God, it can be exhausting. And we just wear ourselves out and we frustrate ourselves and we're upset. Then it doesn't work. We're disappointed. Why? Solomon tells us in Ecclesiastes 1:14, he says, I have seen all things that are done under the sun. All of them are meaningless. A chasing after the wind. It's tiring to do all that stuff. He says, like chasing the wind. So I have a homework assignment for you this afternoon. Sometime this afternoon, I want you to go outside and chase the wind. I know it's going to be a little awkward. You might want to make sure nobody's looking. I want you to chase the wind. You have 30 seconds. If you're in good shape, you go 40 seconds. Chase the wind. See how that goes for you. Okay? In fact, I might even sit in my chair this afternoon and I might just laugh thinking about hundreds of people chasing the wind. Just count. See how that goes for you. It won't go very well. That's what Solomon tells us. When you put these other, all he's tried everything, and they don't work. It's just exhausting. It just doesn't work. He says you're going to be frustrated. You're going to be tired. I don't know if you remember this article a few years ago. This was back when, probably more than a few years ago now, but when AOL was the big internet provider and search engine and all those kind of things. They did this, they made public this search or this research they had done. And they chose 650,000 people and they assigned a number to each of these people. They didn't tell anybody what their name was, they just assigned a number. So if it was you, maybe you were number 54,327. That was the number. They didn't tell people who they were, but they just assigned a number. And each of these numbers, they would tell you their search history. This person looks at Ford trucks, Chicago Bear stores, home decor, and this particular elementary school. And they didn't think anybody could ever figure out, you know, who the people were. Y'all remember this? Well, New York Times got a hold of this. And they were able, through the tracking, without a name, to identify all these people by their search history. They figure out what truck they drove, what car they drove, what elementary school they were going to, so on and so forth. And they were able to identify these people based on what they were searching for. Today, our searches have a way of revealing who we are. You show me what you're searching for, and I'll tell you what your identity is. You can see the cisterns that you're digging. It's an exhausting way to live. Then there's one more. There's just kind of this bitter aftertaste that you kind of always have when you're cropping up the wrong things in your life. It's just like the cisterns that we're talking about. Sometimes the water becomes stagnant. I mentioned earlier, a rodent or something can fall in the water. If you're having to scoop the water kind of out of the bottom, it's always kind of bad. And that's the way cisterns work. You just kind of easily leave a bitter taste in your mouth. In fact, in verses 19 and 20, Jeremiah kind of talks about this. He says, your wickedness will punish you. So he's saying your wickedness will carry with it its own consequences. Yeah, sometimes God has this act of wrath that he'll judge you with, but also there's this passive wrath that just goes along with the consequences of what you do. And it just will kind of follow you. Your wickedness will have consequences. And then he goes on, he says, your backsliding or your turning from me will rebuke you. He says, consider then and realize how evil and bitter it is for you when you forsake the Lord your God and have no awe of your turning from me. This evil and bitter thing he's talking about is to abandon your God. And that's when we turn to something else. And he says, it's going to leave a bitter taste when you reject me for something else. Then he goes on to say, I'm paraphrasing a little bit, as your father, it's horrifying to watch this. He says, the angels look down and they shudder at the sight of this. I provided water for my children and they rejected it. They're going out to the cisterns instead. Let's see if we might contextualize this for our culture just a little bit. Let's say that you're going to take maybe some special occasion. You're going to take one of your children to a really nice restaurant. I mean, it's really nice. You know, Ruth Chris or Jab Zander or something like that. And they've never had filet mignon before. So on this particular night, to honor them, they're going to have filet. And you're excited for them because they've never had it. You can't wait to see them bite into that filet. So you order it, you're talking and all those kind of things. And as a parent, you're just excited for them. And finally it comes and, you know, it's just sizzling on the plate. You smell the aroma of it. It smells great. And you're just sitting there, you're going to let your child go first because you want to see the look on their face. But instead of reaching for his fork and his knife, he reaches his hand in his pocket and he pulls out a piece of beef jerky. And he brushes the lint off of it from his pocket and he grabs it and he starts gnawing. And finally, he jerks a piece of it off and he just starts gnawing on the beef jerky and he won't eat his fillet. How are you going to feel as a parent? Probably a little annoyed, frustrated, upset. Here he's got a fillet, and he's choosing to gnaw on a piece of beef jerky instead. I mean, he's just chomping away, making all kinds of noise. I wonder if that's what we do sometimes. God has provided himself for us, gives our lives purpose and reason. We're like gnawing on a piece of beef jerky and like, it's okay, God. I got my beef jerky. I just wonder if that's what we do. We do with our lives. God gives us through his Son peace and joy and strength. No, thanks, God. I got my beef jerky. And you know, I look around and see people digging cisterns all the time in our country. I'm reading a book, almost finished with it, reading the last couple weeks, entitled The Millennials. It mentioned that only 65% of millennials do not attend any type of worship service. A millennial, if you're not familiar with that term, would be today, somebody between the ages of 19 and 38 would be the millennial generation. So only 35% of them attend any type of worship service. That's not Christianity. That's worship in general. And then some other statistics you might find interesting from the American Religious Identification Survey that those who claim to have no faith base at all has doubled since 1990. It's now almost 20% in our country. And of that group who say that they have no faith base, 75% of them claim that they had faith in their homes when they grew up. So after they grew up, they have rejected their faith. George Barna estimates that 80% of those engaged in church today will disengage by the time they reach 29. So what are they doing? They're looking for somewhere. And they're digging cisterns, and they're digging cisterns, and they're coming up empty. The cisterns of the world will not satisfy. On the evening of April 14th, the RMS Titanic received a message that they were about to enter a dangerous ice field. While the radio operators aboard the Titanic were extremely busy, they were busy sending messengers from their passengers back to the mainland because their passengers wanted to tell their loved ones and relatives how much fun they were having, what a great ship this was, and all that type of stuff. So the radio operators ignored that message. About 3 o'clock in the morning, they received another message, and this was from a ship nearby telling them that they were in a very dangerous ice field. One of the radio operators answered in Morse code, shut up, I'm busy. I think you know the rest of the story. I wonder how many Christians today, I mean, obviously they wouldn't just come out and say that to God, but in their lifestyle they're saying to God, shut up, shut up. God's trying to get their attention and they're just ignoring the warnings. And they're looking for satisfaction everywhere. And they're hitting the iceberg and they're drowning.